So, the term Ecclesiastes, what did we learn Sunday that this term is connected to? Ecclesiastes, what's at the root of it? What's it about?
Ecclesia.
Yeah, it is connected to the Greek term ecclesia, which is translated church in our New Testaments. It is the one who gathers the assembly and addresses the assembly. It's a form of the word that we get ecclesia from. And so it has to do with gathering the assembly. It's really about the one who's addressing the assembly. And he's called, in most English translations, the preacher. What else did we learn about his identity? What did we say was possible regarding who it is? Possibly Solomon. And we say that because he's identified as king of Israel, son of David. However, all the kings after David could be described as sons of David. But as we'll see in chapter 1 and 2, there are some statements that really remind us of Solomon. But I would say that it's not conclusive. And it's really not even all that necessary. We did say, though, something about the time frame from which this book is generated. What time is this in Israel's history, generally? It's a golden age. It's a zenith age. There is peace and prosperity, but emptiness. It does really go well with each other. How is the book unique as far as biblical books go? Even from our sampling Sunday. What's it doing? It's maybe unique in biblical literature.
It's from man's perception.
Yeah, life under the sun. Right. We saw two things. The expression life under the sun, and the writer keeps saying, I saw this. I perceived that. So it's looking through human eyes at human life, life under the sun. Occasionally, he'll puncture that with some statement about God. Please remember that. While so much of what is written in the Bible is written totally from God's perspective, even from some of the historical works like Genesis and Exodus and Joshua, it's really objective, but it's still giving us God's history of it. Okay, this book has moments where God punctures it. But God, think about that tone. You're saying this, you're saying this, you're saying this. But God, there's another perspective. But that's not the thrust of the book. That's not the tenor of the book. It's about life under the sun, which basically, if you take God out of the equation, we know you can't really do that. There would be no life without God. But we understand that people do try to live that way. And so that's the perspective. It's very unique. It's not exclusive to Ecclesiastes, because we mentioned how that, there are statements in the Psalms occasionally like that, and even Job. I mean, basically what's happening with Job and his friends is they're looking at what had happened on earth to Job, and they're trying to make sense of it. And they start surmising that God is doing this and God is doing that, but none of them knew what God was doing until he finally speaks at the end. And then they still don't know everything they wanted to know. And so we do see this kind of approach in other places, but it's really, really heavy here. It's dominant here in the book of Ecclesiastes. So I want you to watch for this pattern. And you'll see this cycle through the writings here. There is some kind of observation that he makes. And he'll make conclusions. It's very clear when he's making a conclusion. For instance, he does this in verse 24 of chapter 2. There's nothing better for a person than that he should. Okay, he's making a conclusion and he's also giving advice there. So watch how that he makes observations. He'll draw conclusions and then he'll give counsel or advice. You should do this. You should, respond this way and so forth. And sometimes there's some material in this that is very proverbial. So we actually are still reading in the Proverbs right now, and we'll encounter some statements that remind us of some of the contents of the Proverbs. So let's get into chapter 1. Let's read this here. Les, will you read verses 1 through 11 for us, please?
The words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun also rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is what will be, and that which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after.
All right, thank you. What's happening in this introduction here to the book is that there is a central observation that he makes, and even he cites a puzzle. He's trying to make sense of things, and you also sense frustration in what he's writing. This is all centered around this opening statement about all is vanity. We talked about how that I thought chapter 3, verse 13 in some ways, rather chapter 3, verse 11 in some ways, was like a theme verse. I think it does undergird everything that's happening in the book. But the thing that is frequently stated in this book is stated right here at the beginning. And in a way, this is the stated theme. And that is, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Now, let's just push pause for a second before we even define that. Let's let the book speak. We could quickly say, whoa, 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 whoa. Life's not empty. There's good. And certainly, if you're going to be a Christian, there are all kinds of good things you see in it, and it's going to end up great. Yeah, all that's true. That's true. But hear him out. Because from a certain perspective, this is how life looks. So you got to let him have his perspective. I mean, we all understand that truth is truth that's revealed from God, and there is no such thing as my truth and your truth and so forth. But there is such thing as perspective. And your perspective on things is different than mine, and mine is different because we're looking at things differently. We've had different experiences. We've been exposed to different events and different people and so forth. And there is something legitimate about each individual's perspective. And we could draw the wrong conclusions from that perspective. But there is something to that. And so let the preacher have his perspective, so to speak. So here's the operative term, vanity. Literally, this term means vapor or breath. It's like you go out on a cold morning and you exhale and you see your breath in a little mist, but you only see it how long? It's just fleeting. And there's nothing to it. There's no substance to it. And so that's exactly what this term means. It's synonymous to terms like fleeting or worthless or empty or even absurd, in a way, would be part of the connotation, because he's going to talk here in the next several verses about how much activity there is, how much labor there is. But even after all that toil and all that labor, there's nothing. That's absurd, isn't it? So that's a legitimate connotation. This idea, though the words are different in Old and New Testament, that idea is commonly found in two places in the Bible. One is in the Old Testament in describing the idols. Idols are depicted as vain all the time. And it's the same word there. Idols are vain, or they're empty. There's nothing to them. You can bow to them. You can worship them. You can pray to them. But it's not going to do any good. They're empty. There's nothing to them. The other place, and this is the same concept, is over in the New Testament, as well as some places in the Old Testament, like the Psalms, to describe how fleeting life is. The idea like your life is a vapor, like over in James. And there are statements like that in Psalms too. It's a vapor. There it is and it's gone. Another common analogy for how brief life is the idea of grass. Grass grows up, and there it's flourishing, and then it's mowed down by the evening. It's gone. And same kind of idea. Well, this term vanity or emptiness, it applies to everything under the sun. That's very comprehensive. And here's the question. Look in verse 3. What's the question that he is applying as he looks around?
What advantage does man have under the sun?
With all the toil, all the work, what's the gain? What's the gain? What's the profit? What's the point? What's the advantage? That's his question. What good comes from everything you see around you and from all the work and toil and labor around you? Okay? And it's interesting, we encounter the idea of the sluggard in the book of Proverbs and laziness. That's not at work in Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes mainly depicts people busy, active, working, doing this, trying that. And even with all that toil, there's emptiness. It's very common for people to have the concept, the philosophy that, you know, if you work hard enough, all kinds of great things will happen. Well, we learn from Proverbs that there are some general truths about working hard and being responsible and being, you know, a person of activity and so forth. But from another perspective, it doesn't matter how much you work, how hard you work. There is still, from one perspective, emptiness in that. And so then he moves from, here's my declaration, all is vanity. And I concluded that as I was trying to figure out what gain or profit there is in life. And then he starts piling up evidence. He'll keep coming back to conclusions and observations, but as he does that, he piles up evidence. And this is especially true the first few chapters. What's the evidence about? Starting in verse 4 all the way down through verse 8, what's the evidence? What is he citing? Okay. Things happen. The same things happen. He describes the cyclical nature of earthly living. You work, but you get nowhere. He's depicting a treadmill, right? It's just, you're just running in place. You're getting nowhere. He depicts life as froth with activity. What's some of the activity that he depicts? Sun, the wind, the water cycle. He doesn't get into the specifics like we know, but he talks about the streams run into the sea, but the sea is not full because the water returns back where it started from. And we understand how that works. Water evaporates, goes up into the atmosphere, forms clouds, drops down as rain. That water soaks into the earth. In some places it gathers in places like ponds and lakes. Other places it forms streams and creeks, and then they turn into rivers, and then they run into the sea. And from the streams and the creeks and the rivers and the lakes and the ponds,
cycle after cycle,
cycle after cycle, all that water, wherever it's at, is evaporating, and it's just completely running back through over and over again, okay? And that is just, you know, you ever thought about a molecule of water where it's been? It's maddening. You can't. And it never stops. Verse 8, all things are full of, English Standard says weariness. Other translations say what? All things are full of labor. Okay? A man cannot utter it. You just can't comprehend all that's going on out there. It's a busy place, fraught with activity. But what does it get us? He's depicting that it's all vain. It's just an endless cycle. What are some of the things that you see that fit that pattern? It's just an endless cycle. You do it and you got to do it again and do it and do it again. Yard work, laundry. You got to get up and go to work every day. Oh, it's Monday, okay? And it's like, Friday, yeah. And the next thing, it was Monday again. Okay. It's that cycle. What else? Laundry, yard work.
Dishes.
That sink is like that. And you get them all clean. Next thing you know, who snuck in here and put dirty dishes in there? I mean, it's that kind of thing. What else? Okay. Computer upgrades. Software upgrades.
Seasons of the year.
Okay. So
the. Not many simple phones these days.
Okay. That's right. They're very complicated. And the leaves come out and they're the trees are budding in the spring, and then the leaves come out and it's green. And next thing you know, they're brown and they fall. Next thing you know, they come back out again. It's just that over and over and over and over. I wonder how many leaves have been produced over time. Verse 8, all things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. Who could ever count the leaves? Can't get close to calculating that. I'm sure some person would love to calculate. Put a scientist in one room and calculate one in the other, and they'll probably miss it different by, 80 billion or something like that. What were you going to say? Car?
Yeah.
Car maintenance, oil changes, gasoline. I just filled it up. Got to fill it up again. And I mean, it's just, you see this? See how real this is? See how real life this book is? And then he goes in a little bit different direction. In 9, in 10, and even 11. It's a little bit variation to this theme. What's the variation in 9, 10, and 11?
I think it's history repeats itself.
History repeats itself? But even after it repeats itself, what is it accomplishing? Nothing. There's nothing new. There's no new thing under the sun.
Companionship makes things a little better in
those
verses.
I'm
in the wrong chapter.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah, so he's talking about what has done, is what's going to happen. Okay. Can anything be said? What is new? I think that verse 10 might strike the modern as completely nonsense. What do you mean? When I was growing up, we didn't have cell phones. Now we've got them. I mean, and that kind of thing. Well, there are always new technologies. But guess what? There was a time when people said, you keep putting your eyes on that and you'll go blind. You're just wasting your life sitting there looking at that all the time. You know what they were talking about? They were talking about books. You're just going to strain your eyes, and you ought to be out there doing something instead of sitting around reading these books. And then they said that about TV, and now it's about, the internet. So really, there is no new thing. Earl's talking about car problems. You want to long for a horse and buggy? The wheels break. The suspension gives out. The horse gets lame. The horse gets sick. The horse falls over and dies. I mean, it's just same old problems. Maintenance. You put gas in the car or you put hay in the horse, and feed in the horse, oats in the horse. It's the same thing. And they both have exhaust. And they both have times when you go out and they're not functioning correctly and right. I mean, it's just, there is nothing new. From one perspective, there is no new thing. And he talks about, and people long for this in verse 11. People come along and they think they're going to be the exception. My life is not going to be in vain. But when their life is done, what happens in verse 11? They die, and what?
Forgotten.
There's just another number. I spent a big chunk of my life working with history, reading it, studying it, teaching it. There are two things in the Bible that just keep cropping up in history. One is, there's Jesus, and there's nobody else like him in history. There's nobody else like him. And we'll talk about that probably Sunday. The other thing is this book. Everything in this book. It just keeps popping up. It's plastered all over history. I'm going to be the exception. We're going to be the exception. Our generation, our culture is going to be the exception. Our nation is going to be the exception, when really you're just part of this vicious cycle, this unending cycle of really there is no new thing under the sun. And in the end, what profit is it? I mean, you look at some of the great empires, ruins. They're gone. It's just a vicious, empty kind of cycle. Okay, Earl?
Something you just said reminded me of that old song, Class of 57 Had Streams.
I can't believe you brought this up, because I'm about to go in that direction, but I want to hear what you... No, not about that, but something else. I want... Tell me again, the Class of 57? Oh, yes.
Yes. They thought they were going to set the world on fire and they were going to change the world, and after it was all said and done, they were going to be different from anybody else.
Okay. Great segue. Go over with me to Acts 17. Don't get whiplash. We're going to Acts, but there is a link here, and Earl just illustrated it. In Acts 17, Paul is speaking to the philosophers in Athens, and he's trying to introduce to them the unknown spiritual God. And one of the points he makes in verse 28 is that in him we live and move and have our being. And then he says, as even some of your own poets have said, we are indeed his offspring. His point is that there is a universal brotherhood to humanity under the universal fatherhood of the Creator. And to drive home his point, at the end of verse 28, what did he use? A Greek poet. We're not quite sure which poet this is. Evidently, it was so well known at the time that they knew who it was. So, Bible truth is unlike anything else. But God has baked in his truth all through life. And it's oftentimes the poets who actually produce poems, or maybe they produce literature, stories, or they produce poems that are turned into songs, that really, really expose the realities of life, and thus the truth God wants us to see. So several times in this class, I'm going to throw out a quote from a poet or a song or something like that, and I want you all to do the same thing, just like Earl just did. If there's something that we're studying and you think of a lyric in a song or a line in a movie or a line in a novel, bring it up. I want to hear it. The one I think of when it comes, at least at this point in chapter 1, is a statement made by Sidney Smith. He was actually a religious guy. He was actually a minister in the Anglican Church in the early 19th century, but he was also a popular wit and poet and writer. He said, speaking of mankind, he said, and this is early 19th century, he said he has spent all his life in letting down empty buckets into empty wells, and he's frittering away his age and trying to draw them up again. Ecclesiastes 1, isn't it? Really is. Okay, anybody else have one pop in your head before we leave? Go past verse 11. All right, share those with us when you think of one, or you may think of one during the week. Write it down and bring it to class. I'd love to hear it. So look at verses 12 to 18 now. 12 to 18. Can you read that for us, Elaine, verse 12 to 18?
I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I realized that this also is striving after wind, because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain.
All right, thank you. So this book is layered. He'll cycle back through some of the same ideas, but throw new things in. And here he actually depicts the search he's going to go on. We've already got a taste for this. You know, everything's vanity, he concludes. And he asks the question, what gain or what profit is there in all of our toil? And now he comes back to this in a very sort of proper way. He's going to tackle this again. And in verse 13, he describes the task. What's the task in verse 13 that he's tackling? He applied his heart to what? To seek out by wisdom what? What's the object? The object's not wisdom. Wisdom is the avenue. All that's done under the sun. Now, we know what he's getting at. If you go back to verse 3. What does he mean, all that's done under the sun? He's going to try to look at all that's done under the sun. Well, verse 3, what gain is there?
What is the purpose of life?
What's the purpose of life? And that's what he's asking in verse 3, what gain is there and all that you're doing in life under the sun? And in verse 13, he comes at this again and he puts it this way. Search out by wisdom. He is not approaching this in some kind of sloppy, haphazard way. He's going to try to use the human ability to reason and think and see through things and analyze and look down the path and not just use intelligence, but also use judgment to try to figure out what profit there is in life under the sun. But yet, as he embarks on this, he makes an observation that it is a little bit disturbing. What does he say at the end of verse 13?
First of it is an affliction.
Yeah, at the end of verse 13, what does he say about this, this trying to figure out life under the sun? It's a grievous task or an unhappy business. What did we see Sunday when we looked at and discussed chapter 3, verse 11, what did we see there? We talked about, we even made the parallel to Eve. Humans want what? Humans long for what? Knowledge, understanding, meaning, purpose. Cats don't do that. Squirrels don't do that. Daffodils don't do that. Daffodils don't get depressed because they feel like their life's not going somewhere. Cats don't say, you know, I've lived a pretty good life for 5 years, but I think I'm going to go back and get more schooling and take another direction and find more meaning in my life. I mean, cats don't do that. Humans are always, what do I need to do now? How can I find meaning here? And what's the point of this? And so forth. And so this is that idea in chapter 3, verse 11. God has put eternity in our hearts. We're able to understand the spiritual and grasp for that which is beyond life under the sun. However, according to what he says in chapter 1, verse 13, and chapter 3, verse 11, What are we up against as humans in trying to do this? It's what? We're up against God. Who is going to understand all the meaning of everything? Only God. We long to understand what God understands, but we can't do it. And that was part of Eve's temptation. She was going to be wise like God. She did become wise like God. Do what?
And it cost everybody.
Okay. And she got wisdom, but not wisdom like God. And so he says at the onset here, in these two early places, trying to understand the purpose and meaning and point of life, we're limited. Only God's going to do that. Wasn't that Job's experience? Did Job fully understand what was happening to him? In the end? No. What was he told in the end by God? I'm God and you're not. I'm the one that made this. I'm the one that created that. Did you do this? Can you tell me how much snow there is, Job? It's like the leaves. You know, God could tell us how many leaves have ever been produced. God could tell us that. We can never grasp that. And so, yeah, Darrell.
Part of this perspective too is what you know, whether you have the knowledge of God exactly or not, it's kind of a universal recognition that there's something broken about the world and life under the sun. And then like Earl mentioned, a young class of 57, they're gonna go set the world on fire and fix it, and eventually you run up against the wall and you realize you can't fix it.
It's another sub-theme to the book. There are things broken in this world. Yeah. And speaking of we'll get to that in just a second. He actually makes his conclusion before he gives some of the evidence. I mean, he says there in verse 14, I've seen everything under the sun. Behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. Why would you state your conclusion before you finished your evidence? What might be the reason why you would do that? Why is that effective?
It'll lead you to the ultimate solution, which is God.
I mean, it helps to build up the idea that, hey, we're going to look at the evidence, but guess what? We're not going to find what we want. Which then indirectly should lead to God. Yeah. He says here, all is vanity, and he introduces this other little dimension, but it's on the same track, grasping for the wind. What do you make of that expression, grasping for the wind?
Can't be attained.
Can't get it. It's there, you feel it. You can't grasp it. You can hear it. All kinds of manifestations of wind. You see the outcome, absolutely. Things blown over or bent over. But you can't grasp it. I mean, literally grasp it in your hands.
Say, there's one that I heard years ago that kind of describes a lot of what we're talking about, that, and that is the grass is greener on the other side of the fence, but it still has to be mowed. So there's like humans have this sense, and governments are this way, perhaps even the founding of America and various other countries, there's this pursuit of ideals, idealism, where people think that, oh, if we just get the right people in office, then everything's going to be paradise. It's going to be a utopia, you know, and it's never happened.
Never happened.
And it will never happen.
And will never happen.
Right.
Exactly right, brother.
The grass is always greener on the other side of the fence, but it still has to be mowed.
Okay.
It's an idea, you know, an idealism.
Yeah. idealism is shattered early in this book. And you're like, well, let's just move on to something else. You know, no, there's benefit in this. That's why it's in here. Hang with it. Hear it out. Hear him out. Hear the preacher out. And this is also... You see this demonstrated in Bible characters. So, for instance, I think of Peter And there is a symbolism to this, okay? Because there's a practical dimension, but there's really symbolism. Do you remember we studied this months ago and we were talking about Jesus and the people he met, and we studied Peter in Luke chapter 5. Jesus puts out in the boat and speaks to the multitude, and then when he finishes speaking, he tells Peter what? Do you remember? Let down your nets. Peter said in Luke 5, verse 5, we have toiled all the night and have taken nothing. And then he goes, but at your word, Master, I'll let it down. And of course, he lets it down, get a big haul of fish. And that's when he's overwhelmed and he confesses he's a sinful man and all that. And then he becomes a fisher of men. But I want you to back up to what Peter said. We've toiled all night and taken nothing. It's the human lot, right? I would propose to you with the full biblical picture, before Jesus came, before a person knows Jesus, you'll toil all night and your nets will be empty. I mean, that's Ecclesiastes, isn't it? So, you know, we can get bent out of shape about, oh, this is so negative and pessimistic. Understand that this is the salt that makes us thirsty. And then along comes Christ. And he's living water. And these things about Daryl's point about things are broken and all that, and less is about the idealism. Look at verse 15. What is verse 15 saying? Combine verse 15 with Daryl's comment and Les's comment. Les is talking about people want to put in a certain system. And it'll fix everything, and there'll be, you know, it'll be utopia. Daryl's saying the world's broken. There are things broken in the world. Well, what about that which is broken? What's verse 15 say?
Can't fix it.
What's crooked cannot be made straight, and what's lacking cannot be counted. In spite of all the good intentions and all the creative energies of humans, it can't be. Right. A lot of bumps in Ecclesiastes. Yeah, Rick?
Well, I think, you know, this is what's at the heart of environmentalism, that we can fix it. If we just get enough people together doing enough and doing the right things and doing all, then we'll fix this world. And that's a fallacy.
Yeah. And it's also important, and we'll see statements later, just to throw this in as a footnote. This doesn't mean you don't get up and go to work in the morning. Oh, what's the use? I'll just stay in my bed. Okay? This doesn't mean you don't do the laundry. You don't mow the grass. You don't fill the car up. But it is about what we got to do and what we got to take care of, but it's really about what we're expecting out of it. What's the profit and the point to it? That's the question. Because we're going to see him say later on, keep working. He'll say that. He'll say, matter of fact, don't just keep working. Enjoy your work. You tell me it's worthless and useless and you want me to enjoy my work? Well, this is it. This is the real key, because no matter if you love what you do in work or any kind of work that you love to do, at some point you're going to get frustrated with it and you're going to come up empty with it and you're going to be disappointed in it. So what's beyond that? There's what you got to do, and there's what you're living for. And this book helps to set us on the right track there, if nothing else giving us the negative. Well, verse 16 to 18, he begins at the end of chapter 1 to describe the different avenues by which he is going to try to find the point of life. And his first avenue is wisdom. He says in verse 16, I said in my heart, I've acquired great wisdom. Which, by the way, is some of the evidence why people think this might be Solomon. And so verse 17, and I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. Okay? But yet, even trying to pursue wisdom, what does he say at the end of verse 17? What is it? Striving for wind. Now, again, let's look at the balance here. We've been studying Proverbs. We're reading through Proverbs right now. Proverbs shouts about the value of wisdom. But remember the context of Ecclesiastes, life under the sun. You can apply wisdom to life under the sun, but if it's only contained to life under the sun, in the end, you're still going to die. In the end, it's really no different than the fool. I think the difference in what Ecclesiastes is saying here and the Proverbs is the Proverbs really emphasizes wisdom is a gift from God. And it's God's gift to bring us to Him and get us through and out of life under the sun. Now, later on in this book, he's going to value wisdom and he's going to praise wisdom and he's going to describe how wisdom has advantages. But here he's also saying, if you think that life under the sun will have point and meaning by acquiring wisdom and knowledge and understanding, even that's empty. You're going to come up short. What does he say here? What's the problem with gaining knowledge and wisdom? He talks about knowledge and wisdom here. What's the problem with gaining wisdom and knowledge, especially verse 18? What's that?
Particularly true in medicine.
Oh.
Because you've got the extremes. You can extend someone's life infinitely, and you can take a baby that's less than a pound and grow that baby, but yet you can do abortions till the day of birth.
Yeah. There's always a downside. There's always a negative. And, no doubt man has increased his understanding and his technologies and all that. But, what if somebody came along and they said to you, hey, I'm going to give you the power to make a call on the future. Over the next few decades, there's going to be invented this device. And it's going to make some things quicker, but it's actually going to lead to the deaths of thousands of people every year. Thousands. Some years, let's say in America, tens of thousands. Do you think we ought to go ahead with this invention? You'd probably say no. Well, I'm talking about the automobile. Now, we understand that automobiles save people's lives too, like rushing into the hospital, things like that. But fire trucks getting somewhere quickly. And that's sort of what you were talking about there, Gina, is a modern technology can be, it's got its dark side, too. Yeah, Becca, and then I've got a song for you.
Also, when you're gaining wisdom, it's very stressful and tiring, and you're just going to wear yourself. The more you seek for it, you're going to wear yourself down more.
Right. And I think some of my, the thing that impresses me about a scientist, and you'll see him occasionally, where they'll say, well, we've learned this and this, but after we've learned this and this, we've learned that there's so much more we don't know. We thought there was this much to know, and we learned this much. We actually, after we learned this much, understand now there's this much to know. That's an honest, humble scientist. And they're out there, but anyway.
There is a sense of information overload. It can be quite heavy on the mind.
Right. Let it go.
Just let it go.
Yeah.
You don't have to seek to know everything.
Yeah.
It's a burden.
So, and this is what I think Beck is getting at too, in that we're in this media age where we can know so many things is happening all over the world, but is it actually giving us more peace or more anxiety? And so you hear these kinds of things the last several years with, people saying, hey, you need to unplug, you need to pull away from media and things like that. It's better for you. But there's a really unique statement there in verse 18 about it's like the more you know, the worse you're off kind of thing. And it reminds me of Bob Seger's song, Against the Wind. Great line. I'm older now, still running against the wind. And he says, oh, this is great. I'm older now, but still running against the wind. I wish I didn't know now what I didn't know then. You live 40 or 50 or 80 years, and you learn some things that really are now a burden to you that you didn't know when you were 20 or 25 or 30. I wish I didn't know now what I didn't know then. So there you go. Truths everywhere. Okay, we'll keep studying and tackle chapter 2, Lord willing, Sunday.